This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 65A was recorded on June 1st, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. I'm convinced that we're at an important crossroads in the crude oil market. OPEC just came through with this big 9-month production cut extension that was sure to send prices to $65. But instead, they dropped like a rock below $50 on the news. And even after a fantastically bullish drawdown on inventories on Thursday morning, prices spiked only for a few hours and already appear to be rolling over as of 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So this week is going to be all about crude oil. We've juggled our guest schedule a bit in order to bring back everyone's favorite petroleum geologist and perhaps our most popular repeat guest ever, Art Berman, for this week's feature interview. But it doesn't end there. After the feature interview with Art Berman, we're also going to introduce you to Kevin Muir, author of the ever-popular Macro Tourist blog. Kevin published a piece about oil markets on Zero Hedge this week, and we're keen to get his perspective on Art Berman's comments, as well as his own perspective on China's role in the crude oil market. It's not possible to do all of these things in a single podcast, so we were tempted to break this into part one this week and part two next week. But frankly, the market's moving too fast, so we don't have a week to wait. This episode 65A will air on Thursday evening, June 1st. But in this recording, you're only going to hear the first half of what has to be Art Berman's best interview to date on this program. We're working to bring you part two in episode 65B just as fast as we can. We promise it won't be any later than Friday, June 2nd. But obviously, doubling our normal production load puts tremendous stress on our editing team. So please be patient if we don't get part two out on Thursday evening. Watch for it on our homepage at macrovoices.com no later than Friday, June 2nd.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Now, before we dive into the market wrap, I wanted to mention that we taped part one of this week's show early Thursday afternoon to allow our editors time to be able to edit the two-part series. So our commentary won't include anything that's happened in the markets after 2 p.m. on Thursday. So Eric, that S&P 500 finally got some real gusto behind that breakout. We're now trading around this 24-25 level on the upside with some real momentum. Where do you think this is going next here?
I think it's going probably much higher quickly. And of course, as I've said many times before, it doesn't make any real logical sense. The market's already way overvalued on any fundamental level. But this is what late stage bull markets are like. You get a lot of hysteria and people stop making sense. And, you know, I think there's plenty of room here for there to be lots more upside. As Martin Armstrong pointed out, we barely have any retail participation in this market. So there's plenty of room for that whole stage of the end of a bull market where retail investors come piling in and pushing prices even higher. That may just be starting. Now, there's a lot of smart people that's saying, okay, look, this is a blow-off top. Well, I agree. We're at the beginning of a blow-off top. How do you know when you're at the end of a blow-off top? Nobody does. So I think that the market's been overvalued for a long time, frankly. It's going to get more overvalued before it's done. I don't see a catalyst to cause a reversal. Of course, I think it's crazy to be buying at these prices, but I won't be surprised if we push higher. Based on the momentum that we're seeing right now, I think we're headed to 2450, if not 2500 in coming weeks. And again, we're in the hysteria stage. It doesn't need to make sense at this point.
Well, you know, when we look at the dollar index, I just want to move on there. We continue to spend now well over a week pivoting off that 97 handle. It looks like there's no commitment for the next big currency move. What's your feeling about the dollar index here?
Well, it hasn't changed a whole lot from last week. I still see the bullish argument. I think the secular bull trend is not over yet, but this is all about Europe disrupting the rally. The strong fundamentals for the euro to rally. Remember, the dollar index is very heavily weighted to the euro. So a rallying euro means downside pressure on the dollar index. How long will that last? How far will it go? Well, that's the big question. I think it is setting up a buy the dip opportunity. I'm guessing low to mid-90s. Maybe somewhere between 92 and 95 is where it's going to bottom. But I'm making a guess there. I'm looking to more talented technicians to tell me when the bottom might actually be in.
Eric, let's move on to crude oil. I mean, obviously, we have Art on today, but what's your thinking here on crude oil hovering around this 48 level?
Well, you said it, hovering. And the thing is, we'll save a lot of the big fundamental story for Art Berman, because that is the lion's share of today's show. But let's just talk about today's inventory numbers, which came out after Art Berman's interview was recorded. 6 million barrel drawdown on inventory. Double expectations. Huge, massively bullish signal that the storage is being drawn down and that demand is strong. What happens to the price? It not only does it not make it back to its 200-day moving average, we stayed well below the 200-day moving average all day, but as we're speaking just after 2 p.m. on Thursday, not only is it did it not retake the 200-day moving average, but we're still below $49, and it looks like it's already starting to roll over. So what should have been a just fantastically bullish signal, you know, double the drawdown that any analyst expected, only gives you a small pop in price. That plus the fact that we are decisively below the 200-day moving average, it really spells a bearish picture for me. As we've discussed in previous programs, the first sign is when the 200-day moving average is violated to the downside. That happened at first a couple of weeks ago. There was a brief period above it. But then the confirming signal is the so-called death cross, when the 50-day moving average crosses below the 200-day moving average. Now, it's been really neck and neck, because after we bounced above the 200-day, that pulled the 50-day up, and the two lines were just running parallel. But we do finally have that death cross now, and I predict that it's going to get uglier from here. So I think that there's more downside. Let's save the rest of the commentary about oil, though, for Art Berman.
All right. Well, let's take a look at gold. At least for me, technically, this kind of 1260, 1270 level on gold bullion is sort of a line in the sand. I was looking for either a bullish resolution to the upside or a rejection at this level, and yet gold continues to trade in this little range. What's your feeling about where the next move in gold is going?
Well, I think our thoughts are similar. As I said last week, the big risk that I see for downside in gold is that we've got a really broad sell-off in commodities generally. The CRB index is violated some key technical levels to the downside. Seems like commodities in general are kind of rolling over as the reflation trade loses steam, or people figure out that it maybe was never really meant to be. But the thing is, you know, gold is really holding its own despite the rest of commodities rolling over. Kind of makes you say, hmm. So I'm still in a wait and see mode. I'm actually surprised that gold has been as strong as it has here. That wasn't what I was thinking was going to happen. But as you say, it really hasn't broken out decisively to the upside either. Certainly, if we saw a breakout above 1300, that would change my view, and I'd say, okay, I guess I just missed the boat, and I was a little bit too skeptical there. But for now, I'm in wait and see mode.
All right, well, let's move on to that 10-year treasury. We continue to see that yield hovering around the 220 level, and I'm quite surprised that with the stock market actually rallying the way it is, that we haven't seen a reaction in yield. There's that whole story of the divergence as to which one is the one that's really giving the tell. But nonetheless, what's your feeling on treasury yields here?
Well, you know, we're back down to the low two-spot 20s, and I think lower is still to come. I was in touch with Julia DeClercq this week, and she's come around now to the same view that Raul Paul and Lacey Hunt have had, which is that the secular low in interest rates is not in yet, that we're going to eventually go below that one-spot 34, I think it was, last summer on the 10-year yield. So I'm in the longer term in that camp. As far as the short term, what happens next, I don't know. You would think that with all this money going into stocks, it has to be coming from somewhere, that people must be selling bonds and that should be affecting this. But, you know, as you say, it's hard to tell whether it's the tail wagging the dog or the dog wagging the tail. I'm not sure.
Well, thanks for that market update, Eric. But before we get to our featured interview with Art Berman, our friends at Real Vision asked us to share their plans with our listeners. What's the story there, Eric?
Well, the debate still rages on among economists about whether the global economy is experiencing a return to secular inflation. But one thing's clear, Real Vision is experiencing inflation because their prices are going up by a lot. Our long-term listeners already know what Real Vision is, but for the benefit of anyone listening who doesn't, Real Vision is on-demand video for finance. It's basically a TV show series that's the same quality you get here on Macro Voices as opposed to the nonsense that you get on CNBC and Bloomberg. So it's the only other place you're going to find the quality of content that you get here on Macro Voices, and it is intended for professional finance and sophisticated investors. Because their format is full production quality video, and they do quite a bit more than just one show a week, obviously, it's not free. So far, it's been cheap. It was $1 a day was their pricing model, $364 per year. If you use the Macro Voices discount code, that's all one word, Macro Voices, all lowercase, you get 10% off of that. So that makes it $328 a year. They're upping the retail price to, I think it's $597. So $328 is almost half off of that price. I believe it becomes effective June 5th. They're also eliminating the discount codes, not just ours, but everybody's. That's apparently a business decision that they've made. So the bottom line is basically, if you have been on the fence and aren't sure if you want Real Vision, you subscribe now or you pay twice as much later.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Eric. Since we're the only other resource on the net that delivers Real Vision quality content, and we do it for free, our listeners know the value when they see it. So I'm sure those that were on the fence about Real Vision subscription will step up to the plate. Nonetheless, back to join us again as this week's featured interview guest is petroleum geologist Art Berman. We very strongly recommend you download Art's chart book. Registered users can find that link in their research roundup email. If you have not registered yet, look for the instructions next to Art's picture on the homepage for how to register and get the download. Eric's interview with Art is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is petroleum geologist Art Berman. Art, you have a blog post that just came out. We have a link to that in our research roundup email for registered users, basically explaining how it is that OPEC came with its much-awaited announcement, now a 9-month extension of their 1.8 million barrel per day production cut, which was designed to bump prices up, and of course prices have sold off rather dramatically, in fact, took out the 200-day moving average on that news to the downside. We did see a bounce back up to retest it, and as you and I are speaking on Wednesday morning, we've given up the 200-day again, and we're actually just barely trading on a 47 handle as we speak now, high 47s, just taking out 48 in the last few minutes on Wednesday morning. Art, how's this possible for people who didn't read the full blog post? How come it's doing the opposite of what they predicted it would do?
Eric, I think the issue has to do with fundamental misunderstanding between what the market wants and what OPEC wants. In my view, OPEC is more focused, at least for now, and has been really since sometime, well, early last year, on maintaining a floor on prices. And what the market wants is for prices to go up. And so I think the issue is that perhaps you could phrase it as simply or simplistically as OPEC's taken the long view and the market's taken the short view. The other issue that's important is that markets don't always pay attention to fundamentals, but fundamentals tell me and have been telling me for quite some time the right price for oil based on supply, demand, and inventories is $45. And basically, we've been dealing with what I call the OPEC expectation premium now for over a year, that sentiment or expectation of what OPEC's cuts or freezes or extensions or whatever are going to do to prices have been inflating them beyond what fundamentals suggest. So to me, what's happened is the market expected deeper cuts because it wanted higher prices. OPEC was unwilling to give that gift to its competition, was more concerned about a floor. And, you know, after all, I mean, prices were $26 a barrel a little bit over a year ago, and now they're, you know, in the upper 40s. And so from that perspective, if you're looking at revenues, that kind of looks like success to some people in, you know, in OPEC looking at revenue. So you think it's just a mismatch of expectation. Plus, the market's been trying to adjust down to $45 several times here and just since the beginning of 2017. So we're just going to see more cycles, greater frequency, greater amplitude is my sense.
You also sent us a fantastic chart book of about 13 slides, and I added four more slides to the end of that just to facilitate some of the questions that I wanted to ask you about this. Our registered users can find the link to that download in the Research Roundup email. For anyone who's not registered yet, we told you earlier in the program how to register and get the download. Let's go ahead and dive into the slide deck that you sent us, Art. What's going on here on slide two? What's this telling us?
Yeah, slide two is just showing NYMEX futures prices since the beginning of 2016. Well, actually, you know, back into the last part of 16, early 17. And what it's showing there is that, you know, prices were down around $45 a barrel. OPEC announced that it was cutting, and that's the inflation that I talk about. And so the prices rose up rather starkly and found themselves on a plateau somewhere above $50 a barrel for a while. Then in February, March, I think that markets began to lose a little bit of confidence that these production cuts were in fact really working or working as quickly as the market expected. And we saw a big downward trend that I called the February, March deflation on that slide number two, down towards $45, which, remember, is the threshold that my comparative inventory work tells me is kind of where prices ought to be. Not that, you know, markets care about that, but that's just the boundary that I look at. You know, then expectations went back up for a while based on a variety of subjects. And then by in another month, April, early May, things tried to adjust downward again. We got hopes for this OPEC extension. Maybe they're going to make some deeper cuts. Prices tried to go up. Cuts were not announced. The extension was, and prices went down. So to me, this is, you know, this is just kind of a rational and repeatable trend of markets, you know, first responding to sentiment and going up, and then trying to adjust downward to where fundamentals suggest that maybe the prices ought to be.
And it looks like we're starting to see the formation of a downsloping price channel there, just beginning in that February-March deflation. Through the current activity, we've got a series of lower lows and lower highs. Looks like maybe we're even headed towards a lower low. Let's move on to the next chart. You're showing that volatility is coming out of this market as things are stabilizing. You see a $55 per barrel ceiling and a $45 floor. Why don't you just give us the rationale on why you see those ceiling and floor levels and what you think is coming next in terms of where the market trades from here?
Yeah, Eric, my sense is that we're pretty much range bound between 45 and 55. I think more likely the downward excursions towards 45 are going to be short-lived. This market really wants to take every excuse it can find to raise prices. It's bewildering and confusing because some weeks there'll be an inventory report that looks real positive and the market doesn't respond at all, maybe goes down. Other weeks there's an inventory report that's somewhat positive and price goes way up. So, you know, we're dealing with a market that has an awful lot of sentiment and expectation built into it. But realistically, the 45 is really a floor under which I don't believe that anybody can make any kind of money or maybe even break even. And we can talk about the details of that later, because I know there's a lot of headline discussion about how shale producers in the U.S. are, you know, able to make profits at way below $40. I don't believe any of that. But, you know, again, we'll get to that when we do. And then the upper ceiling, the 55 or whatever the right price is, I think is the price at which demand destruction begins. I think it's important to understand that demand is hugely price sensitive these days. I mean, we're dealing with a global economy that's tremendously weakened by debt and, you know, almost a decade now of currency devaluation, quantitative easing, all kinds of things. And so what we see is when prices are low enough, demand for things like gasoline go up impressively, and then we start approaching prices above $50, and then we become a little bit more questionable. So to me, there's an economic limit to what the economy can manage that looks like 55, or I don't know what the exact price is, but that's what the market's telling us it is. And then there's a lower limit at which nobody can make any money, and that's a problem for everybody. So that's the reason that I see that range. But it's empirical. It's just the way that the fluctuations define themselves, really.
Moving on to page 4, you're touching on a couple of subjects that are extremely interesting to me as an oil trader. I'm going to have more to say about the term structure in particular as we get to slide 14. But for now, why don't you tell us, you're looking here at the beginning, it looks like, of an unwind in the net speculative long positions, which is mostly hedge funds betting on the upside of oil. They're starting to sell their positions and give up. But it looks like there's still plenty of room in the sense of how much open interest is there for that selling to continue. So tell us a little more about both of these slides and what you see in both the term structure and the open interest.
Right. So I've learned to be suspicious. Whenever the long positions start to look too bullish, I learn just through experience, it's time for prices to fall. That's not necessarily what you read in the Wall Street Journal, but that just seems to be the pattern. And so back in February, we saw all-time record long positions. Actually, we saw a double peak that you can see on that left-hand graph in slide number 4. And at the time I wrote, I said, you know, look for prices to go down because that's what they always do. They went down some, came back up a little. But to me, I think the traders and hedge funds are way ahead of what's really happening in the market relative to, you know, to what the headlines say. And those guys, they seem to have lost patience with FOPEC's ability to really manage this market. So as you said, there's plenty of room farther below. I'm not making any predictions about where that's going to go, but this is a tendency that started well over a month ago, and I don't see any reason to, we look at it every week, but I don't see any reason for these particular investors to get very bullish until something happens. And of course, we'll talk about that, but there are an awful lot of reasons to be concerned about more supply than less supply and certainly in the coming months and year or so. The slide on the right, and I'm no expert on this, and in fact, you've taught me a lot about term structure just in our conversations, Eric, and I'm grateful for that. But what this shows to me is that you see text that says November 30th contango. Well, that was kind of the persistent term structure for quite a while after prices collapsed, that prices are always higher in the future. And then once the OPEC cuts were announced, there was just a whole reordering of those term structures, and we went into various different forms of flatter futures to stronger backwardation, saying that the near-term prices are higher than prices out, you know, a year or 2 years. And this thing seems to go up and down, but what it looks like to me is that there's been a substantial shift, and what it says is that my perspective is largely or mostly focused on domestic production, and it's just become very hard for domestic producers to make very effective hedges out in the, you know, whatever, the 1 to 2 year range that they were effectively able to hedge as long as the curve was in contango. So the good news about this shift is there's cash flow in the near term, and the bad news is that they're kind of stuck for hedging forward, and that's, so there's a plus and a minus there. The minus is that you can't lock in better prices in the future.
Well, I'm going to have plenty more to say on the term structure when we get to slide 14, but for now, I want to continue on your deck here. Let's talk about the reasons for more lower prices on page 5.
Right. So the first graph on the left, this shows OPEC plus Russia and Mexico, NOPEC, if you will. This is incremental production that goes back to 2014 or so. And incremental production, all I've done here is I just take the lowest, the production minimum for each one of those countries and subtract it from all their future production or past production, and then add it back in the base. So the total production numbers here are the true production numbers, but it allows you to see the fluctuations. And so unknown to a lot of people, in the public at least, is that the elephant in the room here is Iraq. We hear all the noise about Saudi Arabia and, you know, Iran's production was, when sanctions were lifted, came on. But, I mean, Iraq is the country that has really ramped up its production. And so it's an important thing to look at. And so the countries that are in the upper part of that graph are the ones that are increasing, and the countries in the lower half are the ones that are decreasing. So Iraq is a country that's got a gazillion problems, budgetary not the least of which, and they're fighting a war with ISIS. I mean, a war of survival, really. They need cash. And I just look at this and say, my goodness, they've already kind of cheated on their quotas, and the quotas haven't been in place very long. What are the odds that Iraq is going to maintain its production cuts? I say low. I think Iran has probably expanded its production about as much as it's capable without substantial additional investment. Russia's a real wild card. I mean, Russia's joined in this alliance, and it wouldn't have happened without Russia. But looking at the graph on the right, what we see is that Russia's supposed cuts are really consistent with just seasonal fluctuations in production. They produce less in the summer months than they do in the winter months, and there's a reason for that, and that's got to do with frozen ground. They can't work on boggy, swampy ground. They wait till it freezes. And if you look at the red curve, which is 2016, you see that their production ramped up dramatically in the winter. So a cynical take on this would be that Russia's production cuts aren't really cuts at all. They're just following seasonal norms. Once we get into the second half of the year, their production cuts are going to go away. You know, there are a lot of things to balance here. And then on the negative side, of course, there's Venezuela. And nobody knows what's going to happen there, but it's not good. On the plus side, Nigeria's fixed a lot of its infrastructure problems. They're paying off the rebels in the Niger Delta again. I don't know why they stopped. And so I look for Nigeria production to continue to increase, and looks like Libya production is increasing. So on balance, I'd say there's more probability here that OPEC production will not be able to hold for a variety of reasons. Of course, Nigeria, Libya, and Iran are exempted from production cuts.
On slide 6, you're showing graphs that indicate both U.S. and Chinese imports of OPEC crude oil. Talk to us about that, but particularly, I'm curious if you have any opinion on some rumors that I've heard that supposedly Saudi Arabia intends to curtail specifically its exports to the United States because they're trying to manipulate U.S. stock levels because they figured out that that's what the market is watching closely. Do you think there's any truth to that, and how does it fit into the story you're telling on page 6 here?
This comes from an outfit called Clipper Data. Matt Smith is one of their principals, and he comments regularly on Fuel Fix for anybody that's interested. These guys, they monitor cargoes, and so they often have a very different view, you know, than what the rest of us get just from, you know, sort of monthly EIA, IEA inventory update. And what their data is saying is that despite these production cuts, the United States and China, which are the two biggest oil-consuming countries in the world, OPEC exports to those countries are 10 to 13% higher than they were a year ago. So what Matt Smith is saying is you can talk about cuts all you want, but until we see reduced cargoes, it isn't having any effect. So the world continues to be well supplied. The counter argument is, well, it takes time before you get rid of all the floating storage and et cetera. And I'm neutral on that, something I follow and pay close attention to, but I'm hardly an expert on timing of all that. As far as the recently announced Saudi cuts exports to the U.S., I've got no filter to really tell me if that's anything more than, you know, purely for press consumption. But here's the problem. The problem is that U.S. domestic production is super, super light oil, okay? And U.S. refineries are not engineered for it because, remember, U.S. production peaked in 1970, and we started importing oil like crazy, and the predominant oil in the world is heavier. So we completely re-engineered all of our refineries for heavier oil. And so now that we're producing a whole bunch of oil, it's super light, and we can't put it directly into our refineries without blending it. So Saudi oil, as it turns out, is like the perfect oil for U.S. refineries. I mean, it is refinery ready. I mean, you just dump it right in. It's probably that was by design. So when I hear that Saudi is going to cut its exports to the U.S., my reaction to that is, then we're just going to have to get that grade of oil from somewhere else because we can't refine our own oil without mixing it with heavier oil. And again, this is a wrinkle on the story that most people just don't really even have a clue to. It's not that hard to understand when you think about it. The whole reason that we repealed the crude oil export ban at the end of 2015 was precisely this issue. The reason that there's a differential, a spread, if you will, between WTI and Brent is that there's more limited demand for WTI because it's too light to go into most of the refineries in the world, not just in the United States. So if Saudi really does cut exports to the U.S., we're just going to have to get that grade of oil somewhere else. So I don't see that as necessarily having much of an effect on U.S. Inventories.
Moving on to slide 7, you're saying production concerns are real. I assume by concerns you mean the concern that U.S. production is on the rise and that that is contributing to extending the supply cut and offsetting the cuts that OPEC is making. Walk us through the three charts that you have here on slide number 7.
So the concern and the question is certainly the amount of, you know, the rig counts in the U.S. have gone up dramatically since the really mid-September of 2016, when it became clear that OPEC was going to cut production. And so the question that a lot of us have asked is, okay, that's great, we're going to drill a lot of wells, but is the service industry really prepared? And I'm talking mostly about the crews that complete the wells, that do the hydraulic fracturing. Are they up to speed? Can they actually take these newly drilled wells and convert them into producing wells? And there's been a lot of concern that pressure pumping business is really in great disarray. But what I'm showing here in the first graph on the left in slide 7, these are just the number of well completions. Despite concerns about personnel and the state of the fleet of the frac crews, looks to me like we've ramped up a lot in terms of new producing wells in the three main plays, the Permian Basin, the Eagle Ford Shale, and the Bakken Shale. So that tells me that, yeah, there's, you know, the drilling is, in fact, being converted into supply. So the concern that U.S. additions will cancel out or maybe even overwhelm OPEC cuts, I think are very real. The slide on the right is EIA's tally of production up until, I think, the third red bar is the latest month's data. That's April. And then their forecast going forward. What their forecast is, crude oil is going to increase, and again, that's crude, not liquids. Liquids is going to be a lot more. It's a million barrels a day between the end of 16 and the end of 2017. The other point here, though, is that there's so much discussion about the break-even price for Permian Basin in particular, but the tight oil plays in general. And the narrative is, of course, that, we're just so smart here in the United States, and we've used efficiency and technology to the point that we've, you know, really driven the cost down. And the point is, I drill wells. I mean, that's what I do. I'm not an analyst. I'm not a pundit. And the cost of drilling wells has gone down 40% since the oil price collapse. So I'm not trying to say that U.S. companies aren't smart, because they are, and I'm not saying that they haven't made gains in both efficiency and technology, because they have, but by far the lion's share of the lowering of break-even costs is just because the service companies are desperate for work, and they've deeply discounted their costs. And so the cost of your basic services goes down 40%. Your costs are way down. The other thing is that so many of those improvements in efficiency and technology, they're kind of one-off deals. I mean, you know, you can't continue to cut 15% every year. And so, for instance, the biggest breakthrough was pad drilling. Okay, so you don't have to rig down your drilling rig and move it to the next location, rig it up, and that all takes several days. That, you know, they figured out how to drill multiple wells from one location. And that was a big breakthrough and a step forward that probably saved 15%, which is significant. But once everybody converted over to that, the forward gains are, you know, maybe 1% a year. So I think it's important to keep some perspective. We all want to believe that America's great again and that our ingenuity can do anything. But my perspective is this is an old extractive industry, and it costs a lot of money to do stuff out there, and when I read these headlines about how we're, you know, driving the price down to almost zero, maybe the guys I work with are just the dumbest people in the oil and gas business, but we can't do that. So it's really got to do more with price, and the reality is that those service companies can't survive at current prices. The prices have got to go up.
Well, I think it's very, very important, this point that you're making, because the popular narrative that you read in the financial press is that there have been profound improvements in efficiency, and they paint a picture that suggests that going forward, you know, the break-evens for U.S. shale production are going to be in the, you know, $35, $40 range, and as long as we have oil at those prices, we can just keep on going. What you're really saying is that the break-evens came down to that only because people were forced to fire sale their services at prices that would eventually drive them out of business. They managed to get through that, and they can't stand to do it much longer, and that those prices have to go back up. So that suggests that the break-even price that everybody in the industry, in the investment industry anyway, seems to think is in a secular downtrend, really, it's been a down spike that was artificial that has to mean revert. Am I right about that?
You're absolutely right. And of course, the other component is that so many of these producing companies have laid off tremendous numbers of staff, and so their costs are down. I spent a fair amount of time, and I've got a post out there from a month or so ago on this for those that are interested. I went through the annual report of a number of companies, both shale producers and major oil companies. And what I found was that an awful lot of the reduction in break-even prices is because companies have written off huge amounts of reserves that are no longer commercial at present oil prices. When you write down reserves, two things happen. The first is the reserves you keep are they're more productive wells. Okay, so the break-even price on the reserves you keep is lower because you're high grading. Okay, but the other thing is you're writing down all the equipment costs. You know, the depreciation and the amortization and all that stuff on all those wells that are off the books. And so the headline looks good, but the reality is that the reserve base has fallen by 50 or 60% over the last 2 years, and that's not good for investors. So, you know, as always, there are kind of two sides to every story, and I think the story is clear. And by the way, what I found was that the break-even cost for the majors was just about exactly the same as for these supposedly super nimble, innovative, efficient, small independents. And that's not the narrative. The narrative says that, oh, those guys are, you know, they're quick and smart and fast and they can adjust, and the big majors, they're dinosaurs. No, they're all breaking even at $40 a barrel. So, you know, this is a function of accounting is what I'm trying to tell you, Eric.
The next slide moves on to comparative inventory. I just want to cover for the benefit of any listeners who have not heard your prior Macro Voices interviews. Comparative inventory simply means as we look at the weekly inventory data, we don't care so much about the absolute number, whether it's a build or a draw on inventory. We care about how that compares to the moving average historically, seasonally adjusted effectively, to how that same week of the year over the last 4 or 5 years, what we should be expecting, and we compare it. So what are the comparative inventory charts telling you now?
As you know, comparative, if I had only one tool to use in trying to figure out price trends and where they're going, this is the one I would use. Obviously, to use more tools and do, but I can't understate the value of this particular technique, which is, if other people use it beyond a couple of us outliers, they never publish it. So what I'm showing here, the graph on the left is OECD, so that's the rich countries of the world, including the U.S., inventories, and the graph on the right is U.S., basically WTI. And so by cross-plotting the current inventory minus the five-year average, cross-plotting that with price on a weekly basis for WTI and a monthly basis for OECD, you get this yield curve. And it suddenly clarifies and demystifies where these price trends are going. And it also gives you an indicator by where that yield curve crosses the y-axis. That's what we call the mid-cycle price. That's where the price is going. So all you need to do is say, well, if everybody thinks we're going to get to $70 oil or $65 oil or whatever the analysts say by the end of the year, then it becomes a fairly simple issue to say, okay, great. So how much does comparative inventory have to drop before I get to $65 on that yield curve? What I find for both of those, OECD and U.S., is it's got to go down a lot. It's got to go down like 130 million barrels. That's comparative inventory. I mean, just to drop 130 million barrels in absolute inventory is quite a stretch. So at current withdrawal levels, how long is that going to take? Well, assuming that they just keep on rolling on at the rate they do, they are now and they won't, that's a year. And, to me, that's not bad news. I mean, given the absolutely oversized kind of inventories we've got in, around the world, the fact that it might take a year after Saudi or OPEC cuts, that's kind of standard. But somehow the market doesn't see it that way. The market thinks that, okay, now they cut, it's smooth sailing. We're going to be there real soon. I hope we do get there because it benefits me as someone who drills wells and makes money from producing oil. But I don't see it, Eric. I mean, I think it's going to take at least, and again, then you start looking at what smart people with sophisticated modeling software, what they forecast the inventories to be over the next 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. And what they're telling us is, no, we don't expect to see inventories reducing at the rate that they have been. So the good news, the best news is, it's probably going to take at least 9 or 12 or 15 months to get to where we might be able to support $65 oil. That assumes the global economy can stand it. The bad news is that we may not get there that quickly either.
Art, I want to stop you there because normally I'd say we're out of time. But in this case, the content you're giving us is just too good and too pertinent to cut you short. Quite frankly, I still have quite a few more questions that I'd like to ask you. So we're going to wrap this episode 65A right here. We'll call that part one of our crude oil special this week. Listeners, please tune in for the rest of my interview with Art Berman and Macro Voices episode 65B, part two of this week's crude oil special. That'll be available on our homepage at macrovoices.com. After the interview with Art, we're also going to be introducing you to Kevin Muir, who has some fascinating views about China's role in crude oil markets. Now, for those of you who stay up late Thursday nights waiting for Macro Voices to come out, please be patient with us. It's going to take us some time to edit a whole other episode, so it may not be out until Friday, but I promise you that both episodes will be up before the weekend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.